Welcome to Voice for Choice podcast, the podcast that focuses on China issues with special attention to the Central and Eastern European perspective. I'm your host, Kara Nemečková. Joining me today will be Mathieu Duchâtel, resident senior fellow and director of international studies at Institut Montaigne. Hello and welcome.
Hello, good morning, Kara.
Today, we will talk about semiconductors, more specifically about the effect of the US technology transfer restrictions on China's semiconductor industry, TSMC's plan to build a factory in Dresden, and the EU's CHIPS Act. It has now become a tradition to ask my guests about their first encounters with China, and I won't spare you either. So, Mathieu, when did you first come to China, and what were your first impressions?
I actually first landed in Beijing in July 1997. I was there with a group of overseas Chinese from the Tetu, so the Chaozhou community in France. So a lot of French Chinese for 6 weeks of language training in a school for overseas Chinese returning to the PRC for taking Chinese classes. So I was very lucky to be in that environment. And I think my first two impressions, to be frank, my first impression was about the heat. I had never experienced that kind of heat, you know, kind of humid heat. When I went off the plane, it really stuck in my memory. And then my first consolidated memory was about the extraordinary enthusiasm that I could feel in the Chinese society, this kind of positive energy that was extremely inspiring and exciting, and very obvious for any people, even though I couldn't really speak Chinese well at the time. And I haven't been in China since 2018 now. People who live there actually say that this is the part that has slowly disappeared in the past 2 years around the zero COVID policy and other developments in domestic China.
And do you remember the moment when you decided to focus professionally on China?
My interest was really for the language. I had the chance to start learning the language in China. And after that, I never really stopped. So I always continued learning Chinese. I continued to travel to China during summer holidays. I never took Chinese language at university. I did geography and then political science, but I always kept Chinese language as my personal hobby. And that was when I entered graduate school that I managed to find a way to get my two main interests to converge. When I had to pick a topic for my graduate dissertation, my master's degree, I picked Taiwan, cross-strait relations and how the democratic transition in Taiwan affected cross-strait relations. And that's when I really had the opportunity to focus professionally on the Chinese world beyond the language.
One of your focuses in your professional life is on geopolitics of technology, and that's why we are here today. In recent years, the US imposed a set of restrictions on exports of advanced semiconductors and chip-making equipment to China. How is China adapting to these restrictive tech transfer policies? And to what extent does it complicate its stated goal of reaching 70% of its semiconductor needs through domestic supply by 2025?
The first thing about those controls is that they are effective. They are extremely targeted on China's advanced manufacturing capacity, with as the key rationale the idea that if the Chinese manufacturing capacity manages to reach the 7-nanometer threshold for its semiconductor production, this will have a major impact on China's military modernization. So the rationale is linked to the People's Liberation Army and the Chinese arms industry. And that's why those controls are extremely targeted on key bottleneck technology, such as lithography, which is needed to manufacture advanced semiconductors, and also software for semiconductor design, such as EDA tools. And what we have seen is that it has been extremely difficult for China to go around those two bottleneck technologies. Of course, the key policies that China has to respond to such controls are to double down on industrial policy and subsidizing the industry. And in fact, we have seen an astonishing growth of the Chinese semiconductor equipment industry. And one side effect of those controls, actually, which in fact show that they are effective in the way they target advanced manufacturing, is that for mature nodes, which China produces on its soil and for which there are almost no specific controls, the Chinese market share is set to be growing because the Chinese semiconductor industry redirects its capital and its resources to areas which are also important. They are extremely important economically. If you think 28 nanometers and electric vehicles, you have a major venue for extremely rapid growth in the coming years. So private sector has adjusted. The industrial policy has targeted semiconductor equipment, and you can see this if you track public funding for that segment of the semiconductor industry. And of course, there is also the external element of trying to go around those restrictions by acquiring technology through various means, obviously including espionage. We know that ASML is a major target for China, but also through various education and research exchanges. So it's the whole toolbox of technology acquisition that China is deploying.
So, do you think China is capable of reaching these goals?
So I think there are two different things here. The first is the bottlenecks and the goal that China has to be able to manufacture advanced semiconductors, advanced logic semiconductors. Here, I would expect the bottlenecks to be quite effective. And the main reason here is that there is a virtuous cycle of innovation among the different players in the industry. The tools are adjusted to the requirements of the manufacturers, which reflect specific software capacities that are also adjusted for one very specific purpose. And China is kind of excluded from that cycle. And so for Chinese lithography equipment makers and for Chinese software tools development companies, it's very difficult to catch up with the state of the art because the state of the art is still innovating and is still moving. Then when it comes to the volume and to the extremely ambitious targets that China has set in the Made in China 2020, 25 plan when it was released in 2015, so reaching 70% of domestic production. I think it's going to be obviously impossible to reach those targets in 2025. China is still around 15 today. Other countries have responded to Chinese industrial policies with industrial policies. All of them have targets. I think this vision of China dominating the whole its own consumption of semiconductors is still excessively ambitious. But what really matters here, I think, is which segments of the industry China will be able to control. And when you think of the future of the automotive industry here, obviously China is extremely well positioned because that part of the semiconductor industry is not securitized with export control restrictions. And in fact, some in the industry fear that seeing how the Chinese semiconductor industry has adjusted to the restrictions by being able to grow very fast in that segment of the manufacturing industry, that you can expect some additional restrictions to target that growth in the future coming from the US. We are not there yet. It's still very much targeted on advanced logic chips, but it could change.
What are some of the strongest Chinese players in the semiconductor industry, and in which segment do they operate? I know that, for example, in new materials, China has been able to achieve some breakthroughs, right?
Well, I mean, some of the key players in the industry. Obviously, what has been astonishing for all observers is to see that SMIC, which is China's own pure play foundry, which is listed on the US entity list and which is the object of many specific restrictions, has still been able to develop prototype 7 nanometer chip. And that was last summer. And in fact, some of the strongest measures that the US Department of Commerce announced last October can be considered to target very specifically that activity, SMIC's 7 nanometer production, with the hope that on the US side, that SMIC will not be able to mass produce that chip with very good yields. I think people do not have the actual numbers, but all assume that the yield is not very good and in no way comparable to what TSMC or Samsung are able to do. Another very strong player has been, which used to be on the top 10 lists for revenues, was the semiconductor design branch of Huawei, Hikvision, which was completely devastated by the US restrictions. You mentioned new material, compound semiconductors. Indeed, China is developing that segment, which so far is not the subject to intense restrictions with the help of foreign companies. And here again, I think what is at stake for China is its position in the global automotive market, for which China is making absolutely stunning progress.
And where are some of the weakest links of the Chinese semiconductor supply chain? What kind of technology is China desperately missing?
Well, the two that have been targeted the most by the US are the two key weak points for China. Lithography, but lithography is an extremely specific segment with very few players. In fact, three or four, because you have ASML, which has a monopoly of on extreme ultraviolet lithography, which you need for advanced semiconductor manufacturing. And then you have the two largest Japanese companies, Canon and Nikon, which are both also selling DUV machines to China. And that's it. I think the best Chinese players in the lithography space are approaching 28 nanometers. So it's not two or three generations late, it's way, way, way beyond that. And then EDA software tools is also a major weakness that China will have extreme difficulties to circumvent. The best, most advanced Chinese company, Empyrean, is in fact deprived of contracts with key manufacturers, key design companies, and thus has extreme difficulties to catch up with the state of the art. In fact, you could even argue that the gap is growing rather than being reduced. So these two areas are a major problem. Another major problem, but I think it's common to all countries in the semiconductor industry, but it's specific to China in the sense that China is in a catch-up position is the question of human resources. The Chinese Semiconductor Industry Association estimates that China would need to train about 300,000 people to meet its targets. The problem being, when you look at the manufacturing segment, that all the professionals in the semiconductor sector will tell you that, beyond train individuals, what you need is management capacity for the whole manufacturing process, which is divided in so many subtasks, with no individual actually having a good understanding of the big picture, that even if you hire 200, 500 people from a foreign country to reproduce the manufacturing process, and the whole management is a huge challenge. In fact, when you speak with the Taiwanese semiconductor industry and you raise the question of TSMC, what I find very strong, the strongest argument in this whole discussion regarding investing in the US or investing in Germany and in third countries is not the question of mastering the technology, but the question of management processes. And that is something that is difficult for all other parties. And the largest companies, which are Samsung and TSMC, have developed their own management processes, which are very difficult to replicate for other players. And I think that's a problem that China is going to face to meet its catching up ambitions.
A few months ago, the world's leading foundry TSMC announced an establishment of a joint venture with Bosch, Infineon, and NXP, and plans to build a 12-inch wafer fab in Dresden. Do you think that TSMC will be able to replicate its management processes in Europe? Is there an adequate talent pool to even satisfy TSMC's needs?
I think the whole idea behind that project is precisely the joint venture and being able to rely on well-established supply chains, on a network of suppliers already based in the Dresden ecosystem. It wouldn't have been possible otherwise. And actually, that has been the key conversation in Taiwan regarding TSMC investing overseas. TSMC has its whole network of hundreds of small Taiwanese companies, and all of them, or most of them, are going with TSMC to the US. It's not happening in the case of the Dresden investment, because it would not have been profitable for those companies to invest in Germany for a mature node technology. Hence, the need for TSMC to rely on an existing network of suppliers. Clearly, the TSMC discussion in Taiwan about the investment in Arizona is entirely focused on management differences, labor differences, cultural differences regarding how to approach, your tasks. It was Maurice Chang who said that in Taiwan, if you have an air conditioning problem happening at 2 a.m., it will be solved at 2:30 a.m. And if it happens in the US, it probably won't be solved until the next day and probably the afternoon. And you have this whole narrative about, Taiwan is a very specific ecosystem and people can be mobilized anytime. And that's why they speak of militarized management. And in fact, a TSMC engineer can really go back to work at 2 a.m., at 3 a.m., in case of need, which is not going to be replicated in the European context. Definitely not. And that's why I think that TSMC is approaching its investment in Germany very differently. I think it's a new approach to setting up a partnership to really rely on the existing strengths of the Dresden ecosystem, sharing the risks with some of the strongest players in the European ecosystem. And I think that this joint venture model is the answer to the question. They had to do it differently.
In addition to the TSMC fab, Intel also unveiled plans to construct a computer chip and a semiconductor facilities in Magdeburg, which will also be subsidized by Germany. Is this a sign that the EU's push to boost its semiconductor industrial capabilities is working, or is it too early to call the EU's CHIPS Act a success?
Well, we're seeing investment, definitely. And we're seeing companies that are attracted to this new approach to state aids, which in fact is an exemption system created by the European Union. Because as you know, in the EU single market, state aids are prohibited. But the European Commission created this notion of first of a kind, which exempts certain investments from the prohibition against state aid. That was the key measure, the key strategic decision to build the European single market. So yes, we're seeing some success. I would call this success modest. I think there's a question mark regarding Intel. We are not there yet. But what is for sure is that the concentration of investment in France, Germany, mostly and mostly in Germany, is precisely, you know, the kind of outcome that the people who invented competition law in the European Union were trying to avoid. For that kind of investment, for that kind of level of expenses, you need to have really deep pockets, and Germany is the only state in the European Union with that kind of capacity, being able to earmark 17 billion euros for subsidizing the future of the semiconductor industry in Germany, is really something unique in the European Union. Is it good or bad for Europe? I tend to think that it's positive, but because the single market exists nevertheless, this leads to a Europeanization of the semiconductor supply chain. But and there has been a lot of you know, debate on not very solid ground in Europe by people who argued that it was always, you know, a fantasy to think that the European Union could be self-sufficient in chips, that we could reach strategic autonomy. I think it was never about being autonomous. But what we have instead is some degree of Europeanization of semiconductor supply chain, which reduce supply chain disruption risks, definitely. And that's a very good development. Support for a European ecosystem. You know, some of the companies that are not subsidized benefit from the subsidies indirectly because they are part of the supply chains. And I think where I would need to see some results, and it's way too early. If you forget for one moment manufacturing and investments and focus on another part of the CHIPS Act, which is talent development. So far, all the measures are on paper only. And when you speak with the industry people, what they tell you is that the main risk for them is really problems of recruitment, accessing the talent that they need. So there's going to be a global competition on that. And that's where public policies are needed to make a difference in the CHIPS Act. Has some re responses to that problem, but has not started implementing those responses yet.
We already mentioned that China's goals are way too ambitious, but what about the EU's CHIPS Act stated aim to double the current EU semiconductor global market share to 20% by 2030? Is that a realistic goal?
Yes, that's almost a funny question because as a trained China watcher, I always have my kind of China-related analytical framework to answer that question. I think that in the case of China, you know, some very ambitious goals are really about mobilizing energies towards progress, and that's if you want to be very positive about that way of operating. I think we could say the same of that 20% number. I don't think it's realistic to reach that target by 20% by 2030 when you have huge players like Samsung and TSMC who almost weigh more than states, and you do have industrial policies of comparable magnitude in Japan, in China, and in the United States to revive semiconductor or to boost semiconductor production on their soil. So I think we should forget about the 20% and focus about the projects. And indeed, there are some projects, and hopefully they will be successful and there will be more.
Many people first heard about semiconductors in the context of the rising tensions in the Taiwan Strait and possible invasion of Taiwan by China. What does TSMC's global expansion mean for the geopolitical considerations regarding developments in the Taiwan Strait?
There's this whole discussion about the Silicon Shield, you know, that the existence of a very strong semiconductor industry in Taiwan, in fact, protects Taiwan from an invasion. Or from military action, because the stakes are so high economically that China would not afford to risk destroying the Taiwanese semiconductor industry. And you also hear the exact opposite argument that, you know, if things went to a real clash between the US and China over Taiwan, the losing side would try to deny control over Taiwan's semiconductor industry to the winning sides. And you hear lots of crazy scenarios about how the semiconductor industry would affect outcomes of crisis in the Taiwan Strait. But I think if you look at TSMC, and it's very interesting to listen to what Maurice Zhang and Mark Liu have to say about that. I mean, first, they made a strategic choice, very clear, in favor of the US, in support of the US. They align with the Taiwanese government. It's not surprising. I think TSMC is really an emanation of the US semiconductor ecosystem, way. It developed in Taiwan, but the knowledge, the ties, the customers are in the US. Maurice Chang, you know, he lived in the US before he ever set foot in Taiwan. So there's a very strong US connection to TSMC. And back in 2019, I remember I was in Taiwan doing a study for Institut Montaigne on the Huawei supply chain in Taiwan. I did that small study. And this was the beginning of the US restrictions targeting Huawei and the Chinese semiconductor industry as a whole. And it was very clear to me that there was an intention on the Taiwanese side to build two separate supply chains, one supply chain for the world and one supply chain for China. And actually, at the time, Huawei, for a brief period of time, overtook Apple as TSMC's first customer. And a year later, TSMC had completely implemented US export control towards China. But at the same time, TSMC announced a year later that they invested in the expansion of their facilities in Nanjing for the Chinese automotive industry. So it's a kind of fluid and complex picture. But when it comes to the investment overseas, I personally do not think that by themselves they do increase Taiwan's security in a major way. There's a huge discussion in Taiwan, and it's extremely politicized. On the one hand, the opposition party basically argues that the US is stealing away Taiwan's key technologies, which I do not think is true, because in fact Taiwan does to the US what it's been doing to China and to other competitors, business competitors, for almost forever. They're keeping 2 to 3 generations of advanced on Taiwanese soil. And on the other hand, you have those who think that the US is trying to reduce its dependence on Taiwan based on the assessment that everything could be lost, so that the US needs advanced manufacturing capacity on US soil. This is all based on extreme scenarios. I think what really matters concretely here, the substance, is that TSMC is getting close to its customers in the United States, including in the arms industry. And so, deepening US-Taiwan strategic supply chain cooperation, this is really happening, even though the advanced packaging for parts will need to be done in Taiwan. So there's some irony in the fact that, this is not moving everything to Arizona. Physically, Taiwan remains part of those exchanges. And that overall slightly increases Taiwan's position. But what has really increased Taiwan's position these past few years, as part of this new geopolitics of semiconductors, is the visibility, the international visibility, and the awareness among policymakers who had never really gave a thought about Taiwan, that Taiwan is indispensable in those supply chains. And I think some of the developments in Taiwan's foreign relations with industrialized democracies are based on that new awareness. And in fact, I think that's kind of really tangible, and that's a side benefit of Taiwan's investment in its semiconductor industry.
We have many young China scholars and professionals focused on China listening to us. What would be your advice to them?
Focus on the language. I think that there are different, levels of understanding, and I think it's really, really important to master the language professionally. And I think the target could be, has to be, being able to read quickly Chinese material, especially because it would be increasingly difficult to access information through interviews in the PRC. And the other goal, still in terms of oral skills, is to be able to interview an individual fluidly. I think that has to be the bar, and that's a lot of work. That's a lot of effort. So, good luck to everyone with that.
Thank you for your advice, Mathieu.
Pleasure.
On that note, if you are a young professional or a student from Europe interested in China or China's relations with Europe, you can submit your latest work to Choice as part of our Future Choice initiative. For more information, check our website www.chinaobservers.eu. This was Voice for Choice. If you would like to know more about our work, please do visit our website at chinaobservers.eu. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. We hope you'll make the right choice and tune in for the next episode of Voice for Choice.